This is The Conversation. My name is Michael Shaw. Welcome. Thank you very much for being here. I think you tuned into the right place to listen to Sharon Loudon and I have a conversation. Sharon Loudon, for those of you who don't know, is an artist and all-around culture producer who has been trotting around the country with the book she edited, Living and Sustaining a Creative Life, Essays by 40 Working Artists. That's how I came to find out about her, honestly, and how I eventually got in touch. And she has been very responsive, very generous. We've had a mutually supportive correspondence, which has been great. And by the way, you can follow Sharon and keep up on her doings and comings and goings on Twitter at Loudon Studio. That's L-O-U-D-E-N Studio. So follow her there. And I want to ask for your help. I will do it after the conversation. It has to do with taking part in one of her lecture series that she puts on at the New York Academy of Art. I am in California, so I may need a little assistance getting there. We'll talk more about that after the conversation, though. The website for this show is theconversationpod.com, where you can find all past episodes, multiple guests, co-hosts, mainly Los Angeles-based, but there are some New York people. There are some Orange County people. I'm trying to think if there are people in the Midwest. People from the Midwest to come, people from elsewhere on the East Coast to come, although there is one DC guy. But if you're in New York, Nicole Klagsbrunn, the former dealer, now I guess private consultant, is a great episode with her. An artist named Zephry Throwell, Jillian Steinhauer, one of the editors of Hyperallergic. All those are among the past episodes if you are curious to learn more. I want to thank Sharon for being so supportive, dubbing me a culture producer as well, and I appreciate that, and the great correspondence that we've had, and hopefully we will continue our correspondence beyond this podcast meeting and conversation. You are going to find out a number of things if you're familiar with her, if you've even perhaps taken part in one of these panel discussions, Q&As that have gone on in conjunction with her book tour. You're going to find out still more, particularly about her and what her life has been like, what her creative life and struggles and victories and what have you have been. So I think you're going to find it illuminating. And there's a bit of pep talk mixed with, you know, hard realities and a lot of integrity as well. So, and generosity. And I think her lessons around generosity are really, really important and something that gave me a bit of a wake-up call. So listen closely to that. I think you'll get a lot out of it. Let's get to that. Do stay tuned for the back end where I tell you more about that that lecture series event upcoming. Thank you very much for being here, and I hope you enjoy, and I'll talk to you on the back end. I have Sharon Loudon with me. Hello, Sharon.
Hey, Michael. How are you today?
Good, thanks. I guess I want to say this right away. You are a pretty epic letter writer. Is that something you've always been?
Yes. I think my parents instilled in me to thank people, and I love writing letters.
Right.
Because it's just a quiet time, and I can thank or say hello to somebody at like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning in
right.
my own time in my own way.
Right. If you're being so generous in your correspondence, do you sort of juggle where you have, I don't know, say 10 to 15 people that you're writing these epic letters to at a time, and then maybe those will fade and then kind of another 10 or 15 will kind of come in?
No, it's pretty random. I don't know. I travel a lot. So when I'm in the car, and I'm so happy that my husband, who's the love of my life, drives the car, and then I can be in the passenger seat where there's this wonderful thing that he actually discovered for me, which is call it a hotspot, which on an iPhone is like the saving grace of communication. So I can actually send emails in the car while we're doing long trips. And so I can get out maybe 25 to 30 emails that are substantive on a trip like that. And that just makes me feel really good that I can get that out. And then I can concentrate on the other things once I get to my destination, either making my work or working on another book or doing all the other things that I have on my plate. So it's just more about timing. And I pretty much try to get back to every single person who writes me.
Yeah.
And whether it's a person I know or a person I don't know. And because I think it takes effort from that person to reach out to me, and I want to give that right back.
Yeah, I appreciate that very much because, I mean, you are – you're correspondence is second to none in my experience thus far. We haven't known each other long, obviously, but I mean the culture generally, because as you know, in Los Angeles, in New York, in Chicago and beyond, everybody is quote unquote so busy, you know what I mean? So you have these emails that trail off where you have like an exchange or two and then nothing, you know what I mean? So anyway, I just want to put that out there.
Well, you're very generous to say that, and I think one of the reasons why I'm so comfortable in doing this today and talking with you is because of your generosity, and I just think it's an example. It's just human nature. You want to feed and also be fed, in just metaphorically, by people in an exchange, and I think that that's just human nature. If you like somebody and you feel like you're learning from them, that it's a tremendous, I don't want to say opportunity, but a tremendous moment in time where you can live, contribute to living a fuller life. And that may sound hippy-dippy and maybe very obvious, but I think we lose track of all that. I mean, I could be dead tomorrow. I always think sometimes, having lived in New York for 23 years, there are moments where I thought I would be run over by a car, like dozens of times, right? I thought my life was going to be over.
Right.
And so you never know. I don't mean to sound so morbid, but I do have a philosophy that life is very short.
I have to ask, have you noticed a difference in near-miss accidents through the Koch, Dinkins, Giuliani, Bloomberg, and now de Blasio administrations?
Can you be?
In other words, have you been hit more or less in any of those eras? Almost
no,
hit, I should say.
I don't think it makes a difference.
Okay.
I think it's more about me being goofy and not looking across the street.
Okay.
But anyway.
Got it. So Sharon Loudon, artist and, among other things, editor of the book Living and Sustaining a Creative Life, Essays by 40 Working Artists, which, frankly, was the way that I found out about you and got in touch, because we haven't crossed paths, even though we were probably living in New York at the same time. So, I mean, there's so many things I want to ask you about this book, but I think the best place to start is in the introduction to the book. You talk about your own experience getting out of an MFA at Yale and being on your own and starting to sort of take the journey as a quote unquote, you know, professional artist, and asking of a professor for advice about kind of what steps you should take. And the professor said something like, make the work and things will fall into place, which was obviously, you know, less than proactive advice. And so you were, for, you know, to make a long story short, you were eventually prompted to collect a number of artists' thoughts on their experiences going through this. But in the process, you essentially cut off your own story. So I think that's where I want to start. So you got an MFA from Yale. What was your concentration?
Painting at the time.
Okay. So then, and you moved to, did you move to Brooklyn out of school?
Yeah, you know, I moved to not the same Williamsburg as today.
Right.
So North Six between Barry and White, and for the listeners, they'll know exactly who live near there. They know exactly what I'm talking about. It's in contrast, I'll never forget one time, and I lived with two people, Brian Novotny, who's in the book, and David Yu, Y-U, he is living now, I think, in Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh.
And the three of us were living in this loft on North 6th Street. And I'll never forget Brian's brother, a friend of Brian's brother, drove up at like midnight from Ohio, and 15 minutes later, his car was stolen.
Wow.
That's not actually very funny. But
with hindsight, sure.
Yeah, what's funny is that would never happen now,
right?
Because it's so gentrified. But yeah, that's where we were living. We moved there. It was sort of just natural. I didn't really know what I was doing. I just wanted to move with my friends, and
yeah,
it just seemed natural to live in New York. I didn't really have any aspirations or ideas or goals, or I didn't have a trajectory at that time at all. Like, I just was thinking, I've got to survive, and
yeah,
I had huge, huge debt on my back.
Now, just as far as Williamsburg at the time, I'm just curious, did you have some kind of, I mean, because you could have potentially lived in funkier parts of Manhattan, you could have lived in other parts of Brooklyn. There were certainly, even though it was a long time ago, there were already other artists established, or, you know, certainly had set up shop in Williamsburg. Do you think, whether specifically or just kind of through the zeitgeist, you had a sense that, it, you know, Williamsburg was an art neighborhood?
Absolutely not. I think what it was, Brian, I think Brian found that place, and we just went where there was availability.
Right.
It wasn't really about that. And I think that we were all looking for places, and he ended up finding that. At the same time, I was really busy trying to find a job.
Right.
And so it wasn't really about, let's move where the artists are. It just happened to be that way.
Right. And how long did you end up staying in Williamsburg?
Well, what happened was that I got this office manager position, and the person who hired me 23 years ago is one of my best friends now, and because we continue to stay in touch, amazing lighting designer, Bill Schwinghammer. And I was an office manager. I picked that job because I loved filing, and I loved being organized, and people might be laughing hearing that, but it's just in my DNA.
Sure.
But also, I couldn't afford to own a computer. So what I would do is stay after work and apply for things.
Right.
And use their computer system in order to get opportunities to go forward. And so I left Williamsburg in 1992. I was only there for like a year and a half, maybe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then I left and had my first teaching job here at Chautauqua. Right now, as we're recording this, I'm sitting in the Smith House at Chautauqua Institute, where I'm teaching this week.
So that's the longest gig you've had, it sounds like.
Oh, no, it's just a summer program. So
oh, okay.
I did not return here to teach until last year. So it's funny.
Oh, wow.
It took that long to come back here. Not to say that Don Kimes, who runs this program, didn't want me to come back. It's just a matter of timing.
Sure. And so you got the gig, even though based on basically you're having an MFA from Yale, and there was something else maybe as well, or?
I have no idea, to be honest. I think that had a lot to play into it.
Yeah.
I should ask Don. I think that had a lot to play into it, but maybe it's just maybe who I was as personality and
right.
The recommendations I got.
Right.
I don't really recall that, but I just think at Williamsburg was just the first landing point after graduate school with all that debt on my back,
right,
which I paid off.
Yeah, no, I think, and we'll get to the how you paid it off, but I guess I'm indirectly getting to the point that even though you built up all this debt from your MFA, you also maybe had a nice little, had a bit of an edge having that degree, you know, in teaching positions and potentially other job opportunities as well?
No question.
Yeah.
I think that, first of all, they being schools don't really hire anyone for teaching undergraduates and graduates without a MFA.
Sure.
And no, but it's interesting. it's been very interesting on this book tour because I met hundreds, if not thousands, of artists and received tremendous amount of feedback and through blogs mostly. And then we've had some amazing press in Art News and
right.
Public Art Review and other places. But I'm getting to the Yale thing. There's one person who I haven't actually confronted yet. I need to do that. To criticize me, not saying to me, she didn't feel so sorry for me because I went to Yale. You know, I paid for that education. I applied just like anybody else. And so, yeah, I mean, you make your luck, actually. And I'm really proud that I went through that school, and I loved it. And I really loved it. I earned that. And I in the back of my mind when I was in getting my MFA, I really was concentrating on how do I get my money's worth here, because I knew I was going to be saddled with all that debt because my parents didn't pay for any of my education.
Let me stop you. So what was the dynamic there? I'm going to say it was either that they didn't wholeheartedly support you as an artist, or more likely they supported you becoming an artist, but they could not afford to support you, your education at Yale.
Oh, my parents came from a different generation and just did not understand what it meant to be an artist. And I mean, my father was West Point because it was the military and free.
Oh,
so
got it.
Mm-hmm. You could sort of see that. And my parents were divorced at that time, and it was just it came from a middle class family where my parents were. My father was. Both of my parents were government workers, and so it was never supported, and I think even to this day, it's not fully understood.
I see.
I think that's actually quite common for a lot of people. So a lot of artists and their parents, but nonetheless, I mean, I have a great relationship with my mother, and she has a heart of gold, and she tries to understand and support as much as she can, but it's financially, they could never do it, nor I don't think they wanted to do it.
Right.
And so,
but they had an alibi. I said, but they had an alibi. At least there was no way they were going to be able to afford it, even if they wanted to.
I don't know about that.
I
don't know. I can't answer that. I think I don't want to hurt my mother, but I think that they, if I speak truthfully, I think that it was a very difficult time. She was raising four children, and I was the oldest of four children, and and an artist, and that's problematic.
Sure.
All of that. So money. I mean, I have a lot of resentment for sure, and I think that's one of the reasons why I did this book too. Is that when I got out of school, not the fact that I the separate issue of my family, but that I had that debt, and that I think even to this day there are 5,500 MFA graduates a year, and so how do artists sustain and make a living today? And I wanted to know that 23 years ago, and still the same issue. So I think the thing is that I think that everybody is warranted to doing what they want to do. And should have the life that they want to have. And I applied to Yale just like anybody else, and I worked my ass off during those 2 years, and I'm very grateful for that education.
Sure. So getting back to your story then, after you got the office manager job and you left Williamsburg, I don't want to, you know, we don't have to go through every single step, you know, over the 23 years, but I guess I want to sort of let people get a sense of, you know, the obstacles, you know, and the highs and lows or what have you that you kind of went through as you evolved to the place that you are now. Was that first teaching gig that you've returned to after all these years at Chautauqua the sort of a nice leaping pad for eventual other teaching jobs in the near future, or was that not for a while at that time?
No, absolutely. From there, I went to teach at Kansas City Art Institute, and then I taught other places. But in between, I always have freelance jobs. I tented. I did all different jobs. I'm trying to remember all the jobs. Mostly temp positions and freelancing as much as I could, and then trying to sell my work and stumbling throughout because I didn't know how to do that. And at the time, I came from a place where mindset was that that's how you made a living, is from just coming from a gallery. A gallery does everything for you. I know. I'm sorry. I'm slowing down in my words because I'm thinking.
Sure,
about
take your
that
time.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, here, let me ask you something as you're sort of digesting those thoughts. I'm my sense is that I know that Yale was quite the school to be in for painting for quite a while around that time. I guess other than the sort of subtext or expectation that people would, you know, take the gallery tract and, you know, make a living from their work at some point, how much practical information, you know, was given? I presume, you know, that kind of practical conversation didn't really start happening, you know, until the last 10 years in graduate schools.
It's still not happening there as much.
Uh-huh.
I know that for a fact.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't given to us. I remember one time that we asked David Pease, who was then the dean, saying, what do we do about getting a teaching job? And he got together like a forum to talk about how to go to the College Art Association and what to do. But that came together because the students wanted that. And I think to this day, the philosophy there is that they don't want to provide certain points of information for whatever reason. I think most graduate schools do not give that information, but there are some stellar programs that do, such as School of the Art Institute Chicago, who's been a leader in this, and VCU. Those two schools have been a leader for years in giving information. And it's not just, it's not writing a prescription. It's more giving all the options as to what you can do when you, or options, what you can do to make a living when you get out as an artist, or just giving information about how artists sustain a creative life and what the reality is of a gallery artist partnership.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think as you're saying that, I'm thinking, what would a program for artists going out into the world via graduate school, or in some cases undergrad, look like from a mentor, you know, or a teacher? To me, it would be something along the lines of, these are your options. You can go into a job in the art world as a preparator, as a gallery, you know, as a gallery person, you know, on the more administrative or sales side. Let's see, you can go into teaching, of course, and here's how you would do that. Okay, you're not going to go into the art world. You can go into web design. You can go into web engineering. Here's how you do that. You know what I mean? That would be something like the ideal conversation that a teacher would have. But God forbid, right, that would ever come out of a teacher's mouth.
Well, I think like I said, there are schools that are doing that. And I do think that's definitely, like, I teach professional practice and I try to give all options, but also, like, how to apply for an opportunity. There's so many opportunities out there, and it's the best time ever to be an artist. I mean, a lot of artists don't think out of the box. And I think that, like, some artists think to themselves, well, I'm a painter, so I'm only going to apply for painting things. But they may not think that, well, actually, public art, there's wonderful things that are happening in public art that apply to painters. So, I mean, they may think, oh, that's just for sculptors, and they eliminate it altogether rather than just exploring it. But so I think that in addition to what you're saying, and different models of how to live a creative life, there's wonderful things to apply for out there, too, and how to research and the practice of researching and finding things and having the currency of an amazing mailing list and developing your audience and mm-hmm. just communicating, just as we started the conversation earlier, with the essence of communicating, because essentially the art world is one big, wonderful community that's actually small too at the same time. And it just in the generosity of spirit as we make work, it's the same in how we communicate and how we think about experiencing opportunities and collaboration with so many people.
Sharon, I think I need to sign up for your class. Can you put me on the waiting list?
No, you don't. Oh my God, you are too funny.
You know, as you're saying that, I'm wondering, maybe this is your second book. All these, you know, where to look for all these resources.
That's really, really nice. That's very, very nice. But my second book, that's really nice of you to say. That's really wonderful. No, the second book will be another edition with 40 artists, but more globally. And then
wow.
I'm doing a series editor for Living and Sustaining Creative Life, dance, and then one for poetry and one for writing. And I already have editors lined up for those.
Wow. So this has turned into an enterprise.
I don't know about enterprise. That sounds so big. But I do think that by doing these other books, and I picked writing, dance, and poetry because they're also singular in the sense that they're of individuals that also need to be propped up. This book has educated a lot of the public, which I really love. That artists, in a way, most artists do not live a romantic life. There's really nothing, I think, romantic about living
right.
as an artist today.
Right. And speaking of which, can I interrupt you? Sorry, Sharon. I want to get to the book itself and what that process has been like. But before we get there, I just want to see what else you would like to talk about regarding your own arc. We talked about the challenges, you know, of the family you grew up in, the debt that you had after you got out of school, the working, the various jobs. Is there anything sort of more that you want to add in describing the arc of your art, creative life, your artist life, through the latter part of that arc?
You're so nice to even ask or even care.
Why do you think we're on the podcast?
You're very nice. I would say, very nice. It's difficult for me to talk about myself. I think that
let me just say that I humility is one of my favorite qualities in people, honestly, especially artists who are successful, which is indeed sounds like a contradiction in terms, but there you are, Sharon, so go ahead.
That's very nice. I would never call myself so much successful, but I would say I don't even know what that means. A big part of the book is sort of examining what that means.
Right.
For each person.
Right.
Certainly financially, I'm not successful. But I don't think that for myself, success equates money all the time, as most of this country would probably
right.
think. But for me, I'm much more, I think success is equivalent to the freedom in which to work. And so I'm very grateful to be able to do what I want in my life for the most part. I think that I think the biggest things are that the life experiences that have gotten in the way, like living a block and a half from the World Trade Center through 9/11, seeing my husband's studio as a jazz musician being flooded by Hurricane Sandy and then going through a chimney fire on Christmas night this past year.
Wow.
And those are big, big things that they completely overwhelm anything professionally.
Right.
I think the biggest arcs for me professionally are reducing my expectations. And that has been a learning lesson for me all these years. I wish I had that when I got out of school. I think it's normal to be hopeful when you get out of college and think that things are going to happen very quickly or things are going to happen in a certain way. I think this is just a product of aging where you realize over time that maybe the universe has a different idea for you. And that that has been a very, very big learning lesson for me, is that life is just not linear. And so that is something substantial for me that I've had to learn the hard way. And then I think about all that wasted time where I took rejection too personally. I always say that rejection is just a difference of opinion, and I truly believe that. And I think that it stings when you've applied for something 8 times and your peers are getting it and,
right.
and you don't get something. But maybe it's just not meant to be, and it's great for them. And I really believe that. And it's taken me many, many years to get to that point. So those are sort of the overarching leaps. But we did pay my loans through very creative financing by paying attention and using money in a way that was smart, at which I learned over time. And I learned from my husband and other people, but my husband and having people, it takes a village, I think, for artists to live a good and creative life. And then also by getting big projects that I apply for and mm-hmm. and then using a lot of that money to pay that debt off.
I think the part about rejection is really important. And I think if it isn't already, I hope you add it to your professional class. And I hope other teachers who teach, you know, a professional art life include that as well, because I think indeed rejection is a huge issue that, you know, derails people's momentum. It also makes them make bad decisions, like they give up on a lot of things, you know, grants. So, and by the way, just one other thing I'll add before I turn it over to you is that I had a conversation with a guy who's sort of a former dealer now, kind of, he's sort of trying to build this business as a kind of liaison, said it's all about numbers, you know, the rejection thing. You know, you just have to ask enough people and eventually it'll happen.
Well, I agree. But first of all, I would say for you, Michael, I would say keep applying if you feel like that's the right fit. And I mean, I'll give you an example. I applied for a New York Foundation for the Arts grant, their fellowship, that they offer to different categories now. Every other year there's a different set of categories. And I applied for that grant in different categories 15 times over 22 years, and I just got the first one last year.
Mazel tov.
And thank you. But I think that it's persistence, but it's also the people who are on that committee. They knew, a few people knew of my work, and there's one person in particular who I thanked to death. And I'm going to have her in the back of my mind, for the rest of my life, and want to give back to her in exchange. I think giving is an amazing privilege and opportunity, and my heart hurts when I think about that. I think she's an amazing artist anyway, so it's easy. But and she knows who she is, and she's probably hopefully listening to this. And I love you. But I think that that relationship happened over time, where she and I have had an exchange over time, and I guess she happens to like my work and understand it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that building that community counts.
Right.
I do think life is about the people you meet, but also at the same time, it is about the work that you do. And I think that the work, that truth and sincerity towards the work and consistently doing that hard job, and at the same time, working in the community where you're giving and exchanging and being a participant is really, really important. So you are a big culture producer, Michael, and I can't imagine that those things in combination with you and your dedication to your work are not going to come through for you if you still feel like that's right for you, those opportunities.
Right. Yeah. Well, is there anything else? It sounds like we covered your larger arc. You sure you don't want to out that person, by the way, was on the committee? I guess that probably wouldn't be wise on a political level, huh?
Yeah, probably. I just want to keep it confidential, but
yeah, that's fine.
People can probably figure that out. But
right.
I think that she was. But I have, like I said, it takes a village for an artist to succeed, and there have
right.
been many, many people in my life who have been very generous to me over the years, and those people I have great relationships with, and I try to share the relationship that I have with other people and them with other people as much as I can. Because I think that makes a richer community.
Yeah. It's, to me, my sense is that you were a generous, giving person kind of to begin with, and then through that, it sort of has perpetuated itself. I mean, I guess I'm asking that, I'm saying that because I'm wondering if you would agree, or if there was maybe something in you other than, as you mentioned, you know, you recognize that you have to be realistic about your expectations and appreciate what you have, if there were any sort of turning point moments in regards to that sort of generosity?
I don't think I've always been a generous person. I've tried.
Yeah.
But I think I've been, just like every other artist, I think I'm deeply insecure. And I got early on, I have insecurities.
Right.
I get the best of me. And I think that I still regret, like, I wasn't a very good teacher early on. I learned how to teach, and I remember apologizing to some of the students later after the classes that I taught early on. But also, I think that just comes with age in understanding what creative capital is, and building a community and that importance of giving and sharing. But I think I've always tried to be, but I think I was always afraid to be early on. Not always now, I'm not at all, but early on, afraid if I give to somebody, I won't get something back, or I need to hold close to my chest. And that was, I think, that feeling I have, but also other artists were not sharing was a big reason why I did this book. And I think that I wish I hadn't been that way, but I think that that was just because I didn't know how to share, or didn't think I had anything within me.
Mm-hmm.
And even if I didn't know a lot of people, I wish at the time I learned that there's a lot you can give.
Mm-hmm. So what has it been like? I mean, it sounds like this book has kind of changed your life in a lot of ways. Talk about the touring that you've been doing with it. And it sounds, if I remember right, you've been to a couple dozen cities over the last couple of years on the book tour?
I've been to 48 stops.
Okay.
Since November 2nd.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how many cities that is, though. I should get that down. I'm sorry for that. I don't have that statistic.
That's okay.
But 48 stops so far. We'll probably do about 55 altogether. It was only supposed to be 45. We did a Kickstarter campaign where we raised about $7,000. 66 donors gave us money to go across the country. That money has now been expired, and now whenever we go places, we ask for a venue to cover our expenses if they want to have us.
Right.
In addition, this is a labor of love where the 8% profit that I receive is split amongst all the contributors, including myself. People might think, God, 8%, that's really low. But the thing about that number is that it's actually an average. The average for an academic book in profit is between 7 and 10%.
Mm.
So we received our first royalty check of £306.63 because my publisher, Intellect Books, which is they're located in England, and then my distributor is University of Chicago Press. So the publisher sent me that check, which was reflective of 338 books. So I put it in the bank about 8 weeks ago now. It cleared 2 weeks ago, because 6 weeks, and it was $45.
Right.
So when it came out, it was about $441 and I think 68 cents. I might be wrong about the change.
Right.
So that's like, I think it was $10.03 per contributor.
Right. Right. So when you did the Kickstarter then and did the, you know, 48 to now up to 55, well, you did 48 cities. So none of those places had a budget or were able to fund you. So you were thinking, we need to promote this and we're going to do it by going around the country and we have to support that ourselves.
Well, no, some places partially funded us,
okay.
For sure.
Uh-huh.
Like Hirshhorn, some people gave us honorariums, which paid for my expenses, like gas and, you know, getting around. And the Kickstarter also contributed to that. And then the Kickstarter also, like, funded people to go places. Like I gave Tony Ingrisano a train ticket to get to the Lyme Academy, or George Stoll, we flew him out to Provincetown for an Encosta conference, or reimbursing different contributors to do different things as much as we could. So it wasn't just about me. It was also about getting contributors out there and being present. And then there are many places who've given us honorariums, but, you know, they were generally small, so they could help with that effort. And because it costs money to do things. It costs money to stay overnight somewhere. Like
sure.
We did this amazing book event in Las Vegas. I'll tell you, Las Vegas is a fantastic art community. Mm. It's a secret.
Right.
The artists there are amazing. And I'm giving them the shout out. They are fantastic. I want to return there. I'm still jonesing from that fantastic book event there. And the people there at Trifecta Gallery, they were fantastic. They gave us the small honorarium that enabled us to get there. Wendy Kvek really organized everything. She's an artist. Most of these places, it was either a museum or gallery or school, but mostly artists that organized these things. And the power of the artist continues, especially through this book tour.
Yeah. Can you talk about what are the most memorable comments and experiences you've had, you know, with your engagements with people, like face to face or, you know, via email or what have you?
The nature of the book tour is the panels are the best, where we have maybe a half hour of moderation, like a warm up for the audience. And then there's great Q&A in the audience. Like, for example, I keep going back to the Hirshhorn, which was organized by Andrea Pollan from Curator's Office. She's amazing. And Zoe Charlton from AU and Don Kahn from AU, and then the Hirshhorn themselves. It was a fantastic collaborative grassroots effort. And, man, we got 200 people that came to that, and the Q&A just kept going on and on and on because artists wanted to talk and have a voice, but ask questions that were in reality. The best thing about this book is that there's no advice in this book. It's just essays of artists that talk about how they sustain a creative life. Some of the essays are more opaque than others, just depending on the personality of the artist. And I wanted to leave that in because they started a conversation, and some are more transparent where they end the conversation. And so that precipitates a lot of conversation that has been on this book tour. But to answer your question, the most common is still that idea of an artist taking care of an artist solely. And I know that the dealers that I work with and the many friends I have are dealers, gallerists, whoever you want to frame them, would say that they don't want that burden. Because think about that, 5,500 MFA candidates a year, how many galleries are there to take care of them? And so I think that this world today is the reality. The reality is a gallery-artist relationship is a partnership, and that's just one piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. And so artists have to be able to sustain a creative life coming from the source, as the artist is not only the maker, but they're the vehicle for the work. And quite frankly, I think that's so much better, because then you're not dependent on one system. And what if the gallery closes? Like in my life, 3 out of the 5 galleries I've worked with have closed. And I've learned the hard way that dependence crashes and burns. And so what do you do? But I love the freedom of working with different people, different audiences. And a lot of these essays in this book talk about all the multiple things that an artist does.
But what have you been your other takeaways from the touring around with the book? I want to know what your sort of profound encounters or conversations with people who you've met through it have been.
Amazing. I love almost every person I've met on this book tour.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think being an artist is in itself is a measure of success. It takes a lot of courage to be an artist.
Mm-hmm.
I love that artists engage in conversation, that they feel comforted by this book. And then I have great reverence for the artists that are in my book, because they are very, very generous. And I have a lot of faith in our community and artists being empowered. But just the general takeaway is of all positive. I think that artists want to know how to make a living today. And the keys in which that are very common in this book is, number one, lowering your expenses. And that's and real estate is that. How do you have a low rent or overhead with your real estate, most of all, and then all the other expenses? But also engagement in community. And as my husband would say, the artist cabal is always welcoming. There's no membership fee and no membership requirements. If you say you're an artist, you're in. And I love that. And mm-hmm. I think that has been reinforced all along on this tour. It's just been amazing. And I think one of the reasons why I am tired, I have to say, and I need to get back to my work more fully. I really miss my work a lot. Mm-hmm. But being engaged with these people keeps me going.
That's great. Can I play devil's advocate, though, after all that said? When you mentioned the joining the cabal and all is welcome, I just, you know, first of all, you do mention at one point in the book, I think maybe in your intro, about the competitive nature of things. So,
yeah.
So there's one point. But in addition to that, the element of, you know, hierarchy and or elitism, you know, within the art world, you know, not let alone, you know, the elitism of people in the art world towards people outside of the art world. I just wonder how you reconcile those elements with the, you know, cabal, everyone is welcome concept.
Great question, as usual. I love that you asked that.
Applauding is going on in Chautauqua.
Can you hear it?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
First of all, another reason why I did this book is I really know that those artists of which are perceived as being uber, quote, successful. I'm holding my quotes up in my hands right now.
Right, right.
Deal with the same issues as someone, or similar issues, as someone who isn't, quote, successful by the art market. And they have issues. Maybe the issues aren't financial, but they have a whole set of issues that are real and similar. I think that, unfortunately, there's no such thing as complete permanence financially in the art world, whether it be a gallery. I've always said this, you're going to outlast your dealer for the most part. Think about all the galleries that have been open for one's lifetime. There aren't very many at all.
Yeah.
Handful. So I think generally that's going to be the case. And I think that that temporary unsettling lack of security is reflective in society today, especially after the 2008 crash where job security is a question mark. So that is very, very common. And yes, there's a hierarchy, but I think if you'll see that most people can sustain a life over time, they get the prize. Like, look at the people who have engaged and stuck with it, like Louise Bourgeois,
right,
or Alice, or people who are getting their due later in life. And sure, it may be really shitty that, excuse me for cussing, maybe really a drag that, wow, why do I have to wait that long? But is why we're doing our work really for that success? And sure, it's great to have that comfort by people and acknowledgement. We want that feedback because, as Duchamp said, the viewer completes the work, and that kind of communication is essential for our being. And because as artists, it's our truth, our work is our truth, and that's our form of true communication. I want to believe that, at least it's for me. So, of course, that's part of why we do that, and it's essential. But maybe something like a MoMA solo exhibition, maybe it's not all that, or maybe it's not the highest measure of success. I mean, each person is different. But yes, a hierarchy is there, but just like it is in life. And I think that if you can find your audience, and there's timing that is unfortunately not of our control, that why is Jeff Koons right now at the moment the star and has the spotlight, and maybe those who don't do work that's like his, or I don't even measure against him, but or aren't in the marketplace, not getting their due, or maybe it's not the right timing for them in that measure or area of success. But it doesn't mean that we can't have other elements of success in different parts of the art world. The art world is complicated, and I think there are different art worlds, too, all over the world. And I think that we have to keep that in mind. There's also great power in regions, like in Baltimore, Las Vegas, in Houston, in Chicago, in Los Angeles, in New York, even locally. I mean, it's amazing how things are shaped locally and then amplified internationally. So that's how I speak about the hierarchy. And after reading this book, Will Cotton goes through a lot. He has gone through a lot, and he has a great measure of success. So is Julie Heffernan. But, man, they're just normal people who are generous and just like everybody else.
Okay, I think you did a great job of addressing the challenges of a career arc and different ways that that can happen and different ways of looking at it. But going back to the artist cabal, my question based on that idea that I wanted to pursue further is not only the sort of individual career arc, but also the dynamic of artists, dealers, curators, writers, collectors amongst each other. That kind of, friction, if you will. Because when you mentioned the cabal, you know, where everyone's welcome, certainly within certain communities, everyone is very much not welcome. And I wonder if any of those kinds of conversation have come up on your book tour, but if whether or not they have, I guess I want to know what your thoughts about that are.
I think they have come up in the book tour generally. I do think that it's an artist's responsibility to find their fit as to who they communicate with and who speaks the same language, whether it's a curator, a museum curator, or it's the gallery world or whomever. I think that hierarchy, it's unfortunate. People, artists give too much power to the dealer, to the curators, to whomever. I think it's a collaboration. I think that, not to say I don't have respect for them, my God, I have tremendous respect. I think it's a huge measure, and it should be applauded for galleries that they exist. It's really hard for a dealer to stay afloat and open. I think a lot of artists discount it. I wouldn't want to do it. I think it's a huge thing for galleries to do. And museum curators, some of whom don't get paid very much. And they're struggling just like artists are. I know that for a fact. Nonprofit organizations applying for grants and doing so much for artists. Those are all people that should be applauded and revered and respected, to say the least. But it is a collaboration, and I think finding that fit for an artist is their responsibility. Mm. And it might be that MoMA isn't. I'm using MoMA over and over again as a measure.
MoMA is the mountain.
Or LACMA or wherever.
Sure.
You know, I mean, or Art Institute Chicago. I think in different cities, you know, that major institutions. It may be that you have to climb some steps before you get there, or it may just be not the right timing. But it's all, I think at the end of the day, it's all about that collaboration and relationships and how people have what the right fit is at a certain given time.
Right.
And finding that fit.
How do you find that fit, Sharon?
Oh my God.
That's a very long conversation. I know. I wonder if you did that kind of conversation come up in any of your book tour meetings, would you say?
Absolutely. And
yeah.
If you go to Twitter, you'll see, if you go to hashtag LiveSustain, LiveSustain.
Okay.
We live tweeted each of the book events.
Oh,
you
brilliant.
You can go down and see little quotes from different people.
Great.
And I will tell you, most of the artists in the book are extremely generous and accessible. If you looked up their email addresses online or asked me, and I would ask them if they could contact them, they would be happy to answer questions, and I would as well. I feel like it's very, very important to, again, back to the original conversation about communication, that's the core of it.
Yeah.
And to be generous with that. But those people, too, have to. I think artists have to work harder, unfortunately, or differently. I actually don't think so, unfortunately. I think work is a privilege.
Yeah.
And work is an opportunity. So to be able to be generous and not and watch their narcissism. It's not just me, 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 me. It is collaboration.
Right.
Think about it. If you want to have a gallery show, you need the galleries. You have to have a collaboration with them.
Yeah.
It's not just, and also, I don't think it's right to propose to a museum what you want to do. Think about the vision of the museum curator.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just about the work. It's also about how you connect with that person.
Very well said. I want to ask you about what you've been up to lately, because I think it's very interesting sort of cap on your arc that you have now set up a two-city studio situation, basically. So you've been, by the way, is your home base still Williamsburg, Brooklyn, or is it another part of Brooklyn?
No, it was Bay Ridge before we had this fire, and now because we did this book tour, we've just been going to so many different cities, and then we have friends of ours who've been very, very generous to give us, they have separate apartments, actually, in their buildings to allow us to stay, but my studio's in Sunset Park, New York.
Okay, so your studio's in Sunset Park, New York, and then over the last couple of weeks, you and your husband have been starting to settle into a house and set up a studio in St. Paul, Minneapolis, St. Paul, correct?
In Minneapolis, right.
Minneapolis. You wanna talk about that? And did you get a teaching gig in Minneapolis?
I did not. So we, over the past 5 years, since I installed a museum exhibition at the Weizmann Art Museum and then subsequently had an exhibition at the Burnett Art Gallery in Minneapolis, We have felt the love in Minneapolis.
Right.
That is extremely special.
Right.
In fact, they're the only state in the country that tax themselves to give I think it's 0.0375% of sales tax. So this is in their constitution, which goes towards partial grants for visual artists,
wow,
which is huge.
Yeah.
They have, I think, more than a dozen artist buildings designated for residents for artists in Minneapolis, St. Paul, in the Twin Cities. They have a tremendous amount of energy for such a smaller city than New York and L.A. They have the Walker Art Center, which is fantastic. Those curators like Bartholomew Ryan and then the director Olga Viso, who generously gave a quote to the back of my book, who's wonderful. And then you have the MIA, where you have Liz Armstrong, who's a visionary. And then you have things like Pete Dryson has a nonprofit organization where he has exhibitions in his backyard, sort of framed on the same platform as the Suburban that Michelle started in Chicago. And you have all sorts of things happening there, which I really love. But you also have a much lower cost of living than New York City. And we have always wanted to live in a house. We did a little experiment when I taught at Vanderbilt first semester, and we lived on the second floor of a house. And I thought, wow, the concept of driving in a driveway and not locking my doors, that is a really cool thing.
Yeah.
And then not carrying bags around. I just got very tired of New York, and as I've gotten older and I've established a great community in New York City. I mean, New York City, the culture there cannot be matched. I mean, also
right.
Los Angeles has amazing culture, and Chicago, they're all different. But that I felt like I could not afford in New York City anymore the amount of space I need as to do my sculpture, but also this sort of freedom that I wanted that I couldn't have in New York City anymore because I kept getting pushed out. And that's a big point of conversation in New York City. And I just cannot afford it and feel like I always have to find the money in New York City.
Right.
And so instead of that, and then also all these people that we now know, we've accumulated 70 friends in Minneapolis and in the Twin Cities. And I just felt like, oh my God, I love these people. I love what's happening.
Are any of them from New York?
People like Eric Benson just moved back to New York City, who's an artist there, and many other people who show in New York City live in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. And you know, there are a lot of people who are not from Minneapolis that are in Minneapolis and who have moved. And so it's been, we just signed a lease for a studio and separately for a house, and we're going to do this experiment and see how we like it. And I think we will really like it. And I will use it as the base, but as soon as I move, then I'm on the road again. I'm going to be traveling from September through November, and next year I'm going to be out of town a lot. So it'll be our base to live and then work from. And then I'll keep my studio in New York City for a little while and see how that goes.
From September to November, are you going to be book stuff, or is it going to be teaching stuff, or both?
Teaching, book, and art stuff, my own work, and all everything. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Where?
All wrapped up in a blender. Like it's, oh my gosh, just, I'm going to Baltimore for a week in September, and then I'm going back to New York. I'm still doing my lecture series at the New York Academy of Art, which I'm really very proud of. It's dizzying. We're going to be in Tulsa, Oklahoma, I'm going to Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon. I don't know. This is all boring, but very different.
People who are listening to this who want to see you in person, this is where you're going to be. So it's good to know.
You can check it out on my website.
There you go. SharonLoudon.com.
Yes, but thank you for asking. That's really generous. I mean, the listeners that are listening in, I would love to know what you're doing. And Michael, you should also tell all the listeners like how available you are in Los Angeles. I mean, I think all of us do all different things in different cities because this podcast is great because it reaches all different people from Los Angeles. But I think that it's much more global now. I think because of the cost of living in places like New York City, people can go to different places. And that's one thing I've learned on the book tour, sustain a creative life in different places. Like in my book, there are 19 people from New York, 19 people from all different parts of the country, and 2 people from Europe. And everybody sustains a different life creatively and differently. And I just think at the end of the day, New York isn't the end all. But I do think it's important. If you've never lived there before, you should definitely get that experience. But I do think that it's very expensive to live there. And that is a very big thing. I mean, as artists, we contribute to the economy greatly. Some of us have 2 things. We have 2 real estate, whether you're option properties, whether you're owning or renting, house and studio. And to be able to manage that, you have to be able to afford it. That's a big part of being an artist is how do you, again, lowering your expenses.
Yeah, I mean, you are on the sort of cutting edge, as it were, of artist migration because, you know, without going through every one, certainly very few artists live in, you know, especially work in Manhattan. Then there was, you know, the push out through Brooklyn. And as you are sort of illustrating, even that has become sort of financially a bit overwhelming. And, you know, so time to look not only beyond the boroughs, you know, but beyond the state.
No question about it. And 2 people in New York who are really, really trying to make things happen where they're 4 artists to try to maybe de Blasio is going to do something about this, I hope. But like Patty Johnson of Art F City and William Pajada, those artists who speaks with great opinion, as most people know in his work, and those 2 are really, really trying to do things among other people to be able to resolve that issue. But I just could not wait. You know, I just turned 50, and I couldn't wait anymore, and I have to take care of myself as an artist, and then just like anybody else, I want to live my life making good work, and I didn't want to be a slave to New York City.
Right. Yeah. Well, Sharon, this has been fantastic. Is there anything that you feel like we've neglected just briefly that you might want to toss in, or do you think we've covered it?
Thanks. I would say thank you for asking. And Michael, I can't thank you enough for the opportunity to also get to know you more over this time and to continue our conversation privately beyond this, but also to get to know a lot of the listeners who are listening in. And if anybody's interested in the book, people ask me where to get it. They can get it anywhere on Amazon, through University of Chicago Press's website, through my website. You can see those links. And if anybody ever wants to reach out to me, you can email me through my website and see me on the book tour. And I try to update it as much as I can. I basically update it when I have confirmation of things.
Right.
So there's a lot in the hopper, like there's possibility of going to Houston, but it's not on there yet. So I would just say keep checking back from that website. And then also people ask if they're interested in my work. I have four galleries out there. My New York representative is Morgan Lehman, and they can also check out just on my website. They can contact them or me directly, but I'm interested in lots of collaborations with different people. Life is so short, so I would say I welcome all correspondents.
Wow.
There
you go, listeners. I think you have it. You have your opportunities to get in touch with Sharon in various ways. This has been fantastic, Sharon. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael. You're very generous and a great culture producer for all of us.
Oh, you too, Sharon. I don't know if I can compete with you. Thank you, Sharon.
Thank you so much.
Okay. And there it was. I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you got a lot out of it. Thank you very much for listening. Now, I just wanted, before you go, I wanted to briefly see if I could ask for your help. The thing that I was referring to earlier in the intro is Sharon Loudon does a series of lectures at the New York Academy of Art, and she is organizing one for late September with myself and other culture producers, other podcasters, blog hosts, etc. And the budget is quite modest, so it won't get me there. It will sort of take care of some modest expenses involved, but I'm looking basically to supplement that modest honorarium with some contributions from you. So consider this like a mini crowdfunding occasion. If I can get enough of you to contribute $5 or $10, if there are enough of you that do that, that could be enough to put things over the top and get me out to New York for this lecture. You can do that by going to theconversationpod.com and donating via the PayPal link. Or if you prefer, you can contact me via email, theconversationartpodcast@gmail.com, and we can use another method that you may feel is safer or easier. I would appreciate it very much, and you will definitely get a lot of gratitude and personal thanking from me if you do. So if you can, great. I would appreciate it, and I will give you a full report on the lecture and whatnot. So there you go. That's basically what I wanted to ask for. I hope it's not too much to ask. If you can help, I really would appreciate it very much. Thank you so much for being here, and I hope you continue to listen to the podcast, theconversationpod.com. You can subscribe not only on iTunes, but on Stitcher, which is a non-iTunes-based platform. Just type in The Conversation Un Artist Podcast, and you subscribe, and then it'll come into your feed automatically every week or a couple weeks. So that's it. Thank you very much again for being here. Take care, and I will talk to you soon.